This is an SBC Media Partners production.
Swung on, hit high and deep. Right field.
Could it be? Could it be? It is out of here.
Phillies fans, these are your club stories with Murph.
Let's check in with Greg Murphy. Murphy, you got a special guest, huh?
Hi, everybody, and welcome into another edition of Glove Stories with Murph, brought to you by the Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app, Shy Vintage Sports, and the great folks at Phillies Nation as well. Happy to have you with us this week, and really happy to have this week's guest. Most Phillies fans will remember him from the terrific run in 1993 and then the years that he spent with the team afterwards. But what a career this man had in Major League Baseball. And that's what we are here to talk about today. He's got some glove stories, folks, and he's going to share them with us this afternoon. We welcome in Jim Eisenreich to the program. Jim, good to see you. It's been a couple of months since I've seen you, but you're looking good.
Doing well. Thank you. Appreciate
it. Good. Well, thank you so much for being here. And I'm really excited about our conversation today. When I look back, just doing some extra research and looking back at the career, it really is a remarkable one, a long one, spent 15 seasons, parts of 15 seasons in the big leagues. And, you look back at some of the numbers and what you were able to accomplish, it really, really remarkable, something to be proud of, and I know you are. When it all got started, way back, as a child, was baseball always your sport? Did you branch out to other things, or were you concentrating on baseball from a young age?
Yeah, I was not concentrating on baseball. Played pretty much everything. My family was, I'd call them a sports family. My mom and dad loved sports. My dad, I guess, kind of lived and died by sports. Grew up in, St. Cloud, Minnesota. And so we were Twins fans, Viking fans. And the hockey team was the North Stars,
Right, sure.
Different now. But so, yeah, we were fans. And I played everything, whatever was in season. Summer into baseball, hockey in the winter, and whatever else,
And did you excel? I know you were a good athlete. Obviously, you were a good athlete, but were you a guy that kind of crossed over and could really, play well in all those sports?
I did pretty well, yes. And honestly, hockey was probably my most favorite as a young kid.
Sure, Minnesota, right?
Yeah, and that's, I'm not very tall, couldn't shoot a bucket, so I didn't play basketball. But I loved playing sports, and I did pretty well.
When did the focus begin to change? Was it high school that you had to start to focus in, or maybe not even then? Because I know early in your high school career, good player, but maybe not on anyone's radar, right?
That's correct. And I'm old, so back in the day, we were encouraged to play everything. And so, the baseball coach was excited for the hockey season to end, but he was also hoping we'd go as far as we could, and vice versa. So we all played everything, and it was okay. For me personally, like I said, I loved both. I loved hockey a lot. I was a good hockey player. I actually had a few more offers to play college hockey than I did baseball.
How about that?
But as it turned out, I went to college to play baseball, to go to school first. And baseball was kind of the extracurricular activity. Hockey, I knew I could only do one because I actually was focused on school, which kids don't do now, but that's fine. I did. And so to answer your question, the time that I realized baseball was my thing was really not till my late sophomore, junior year in college.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, how about that? Yeah. Obviously, as you point out, times have changed. I'm more your generation than I am, obviously, the current generation. And we all, we played everything as well. But that has changed. The very few guys that are going to be major league ball players are figuring it out their junior year of college. But that's the way it is. When was the last time you strapped on the skates?
I skate pretty much every winter. Once or twice. Yeah. So I actually did not do it this winter. COVID's kind of messed things up for a lot of things. But I do regularly skate when I can.
Okay. All right. Good exercise. Keep you in shape. You still got it, I'm sure. I'm sure you still have it.
I just like to be on the ice.
All right. So you grew up in St. Cloud. You went to high school, obviously, in St. Cloud. You also went to college in St. Cloud, Minnesota. By choice, was that exactly you want to stay close to home? Was that the idea behind it?
You know, I guess in some ways, yes. But the way my junior and senior seasons of baseball, high school and American Legion ball is what I played. We were really good in American Legion ball, won a couple of state tournaments, and I was a high school all-star in the state of Minnesota. And I really wanted to go to the University of Minnesota. That's where you went.
Yeah.
And so I actually enrolled, you know, early in the summer of my senior year of high school. So I enrolled, but I never went. I didn't take the next step. And so I just went, I stayed home and, you know, school was going to be the most important thing. You know, I think my mind and my dreams and, you know, my whatever I was feeling, I felt I need to go to Minnesota. And I had no offer. I would have been a walk-on,
right,
if that was even possible. I thought, well, I don't know if that's even realistic. So I stayed home and went to St. Cloud.
Well, it turned out to be a decision that would work in your favor. Can you tell the story? And I read a little bit about it, but you're playing and you're obviously playing well. I think you had a teammate that was also being looked at as a possible draft pick. And your coach at the time wrote a letter to the Twins. Was it thanking him for something? And then said, oh, by the way, I got this kid Jim Eisenreich that you might want to take a look at as well. Is that how it played out, basically?
Yeah, in some ways, yes. Our coach had connections to a lot of the area scouts. And of course, Twins being, you know, close was a natural connection. But my teammate, I was a junior. My teammate was a senior, Bob Hegman. He was a shortstop.
Okay.
All everything. He was actually a college basketball player too and a really good player. So we were teammates, roommates, and we were getting noticed by scouts. So the end of the college season, we have our conference tournament way up in Bemidji, Minnesota. You know,
way up there.
It was. And we happened to win the tournament. You know, we were going to advance to the next level, which was a regional type college tournament. And after the championship game, the twin scout actually came up to my buddy, Bob, and asked him, which is what they did in those days, would you be interested in playing professional baseball? And of course, Bob's a senior, you know, he was graduating. Yes, that's a pretty easy question to answer. And so then he asked, what about your teammate Eisenreich? He's only a junior. Would he be interested? And my buddy Bob's kind of pretty quick-witted. You know, it's like, well, you know what? He's standing right over there. Go ask him. He'll answer you. And so he did. The scout came and asked me the same question.
And your answer was? Course,
it was the simplest answer I ever gave. Yes, sir. When? You know, and I didn't know anything then. That was the very end of May. And the June draft wasn't until June 7th was the day.
Okay.
Not that I remember that day exactly, but maybe I do remember it pretty exactly. We had 2 weeks to wait and we actually both got drafted.
So, how about that?
Yeah.
So you brought it up. So let me ask you, draft day, obviously a day you remember for your entire life. It's not like it is nowadays. It wasn't on television back then. It wasn't, you weren't streaming it on your phone. You weren't getting text messages and updates. How did you eventually find out? Because 16th round? Do I have that right? 16th, 18th?
Right.
Yeah,
correct.
16th round. And so how did you find out? What was that like?
So, you know, we had the old typical home phone, phone on the wall. The phone rings and my mom answers the phone. She says, she hollers at me wherever I was at, and it's for you. It's somebody from the Twin Cities. Okay. You know, and I wasn't really thinking, you know, the draft, but I knew it was possible. And so I get on the phone and he says he's a reporter from the Minneapolis Star and Tribune paper. And I recognize the name, but then I go, okay, I don't know if it's really him. it could be one of my college teammates pulling a prank on me, you know? And so, but after talking to him for a while, you know, he told me I was drafted by the Twins and, you know, asked him all the questions and blah, blah, blah. And so I realized, wow, you know, I'm drafted. And so I got off the phone and actually before I got off, I asked him, I said, what about Bob Hegman, my college teammate? Did anybody get him? And he said, believe it or not, the Kansas City Royals selected him earlier in the 16th round.
Oh, wow.
And so Bob hadn't called me at all. So I didn't, you know, we were going to, you know, be in connection and communicate, let each other know what's going on. And so I got off the phone. My mom said, you know what, you need to go tell your dad who was in the garden. Dad was in the garden, but a big vegetable garden. And he wasn't in the best of health then. But I walked out and I said, hey, Dad, I just got drafted by the Twins. My dad's eyes lit up. It's like a new life had just hit. And I always make a joke about him setting the standing long jump record. He came out, give me a big hug. And that was a big deal. You know, it was, it wasn't like I was drafted. It was like we were drafted, my dad and I. And that's how it was, you know? And so anyway, went back in, called my buddy Bob and told him, you know, that I had been drafted by the Twins in the 16th round. And I said, I asked him if he heard anything. And of course he said, well, no, I haven't, you know, and I didn't spill the gut, you know, I didn't say anything. So I let it go. And so later that evening, he called me, he said, man, I haven't heard. I guess I haven't heard. Next morning, he calls me and said, yeah, I got drafted by the Royals in the 16th round. And I told him, I said, yeah, I knew that. You know, anyway, so we were, he kind of one-upped me because he was drafted earlier in the round.
Well, you know, he had a year on you. That's all. That's the only reason. So, it's awesome. And the story with the connection with your father is awesome to listen to. It gave me chills. It had to be. So you're in high school in Minnesota, you're college in Minnesota, and then you get drafted by the local team, your team, the team you grew up rooting for. Even more surreal at that point, do you think? You'd say to yourself, my goodness, you know, I'm going to be a professional ball player. I might not have to leave the state that I grew up in.
Yeah, that is somewhat how it is. But I knew I had to go somewhere to play in the minor leagues.
Yeah.
But until I actually signed a contract, I didn't know. But, you know, I guess I was so focused on playing for the moment. I wasn't even looking like kids now. They know exactly where the next level is.
Yeah.
They know their timeline. And I wasn't that smart. I was playing for now and enjoying the time. But I suppose deep down, I did know that, you know, that's Minneapolis is an hour south of us and it's right there. You know, it's like, how cool would that be? You know, so.
But I would imagine also a little daunting because you really hadn't been away from home all that much. And you were going to now be out on your own at age, what, 20 years old, probably, and being sent to the minor leagues and on your own for the first time. Do you remember that as a period of time in your life that you enjoyed, or was it a little overwhelming?
You know, I actually enjoyed it. Now, it was culture shock.
Yeah.
It was definitely culture shock. Central Minnesota to Elizabethton, Tennessee. Now, it's not Elizabethton, it's Elizabethton. And the locals will tell you that's how you pronounce it. You know, this, and I make a joke, but it's like the hillbilly country.
Yeah.
You know, it's just what it is. And we lived with a family, another draftee from the Twins. We lived with families. It was a unique experience. But at the same time, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Now, I was only gone for 2.5 months.
Right.
And I was a little homesick, but I was playing ball. And that was always the thing that kind of, it was okay. It didn't matter where I went. If I was playing ball, I was fine.
You were feeling good.
And it was a good experience for me.
you know, and again, the connection nowadays, text messages and iPhones and FaceTime, it makes it a lot easier. But you guys didn't have that. Again, it was wall-to-wall phone and probably once a week because it was a long-distance call and it was expensive. So it's not like you could connect with family back home if you were feeling down. You just had to kind of had to push through and probably rely on your teammates and your coaches at that point, right?
That's correct. Now, we did have a little plan. Now, first of all, because I knew I was going to do my own laundry, I had my mom. Okay, how do I do this? You know, whites are here, whites are warm, cold, you know, colors are whatever. I learned how to do laundry. And then my dad said, you know, call every Sunday night because we had Sunday day games. Sure. So call Sunday night and call collect. So I used the family's phone. I said, you know, this is my time. Can I call and use, you know, his phone? Yeah. I said, you know, called collect. They accepted it. And I talked to my mom and dad for 15, 20 minutes and it was all good. Yeah.
I love it. So and cool. you didn't spend a lot of time in the minor leagues. I mean, you know, we'll talk to guys that toil in the minor leagues for 7, 8, 9 years before they get their chance in the big leagues. That was not the case for you. The Twins were a youth movement and you were a part of that, a quick mover through the system. And next thing you know, you debut in 1982 in Minnesota. And do I have this right? You have the first ever at bat at the Metrodome. Is that correct?
As a home.
Yeah.
Player. Yes.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's a pretty cool distinction. I didn't know that.
It's pretty neat. Yes.
Yeah. Pretty neat.
I actually got the very first Twins hit too.
There you go.
That was actually in an exhibition game.
Okay. All right.
That I can tell you a little.
I love that kind of stuff, but what do you remember about the debut? Obviously, you're again young guy, 22 years old, I think you were when you debuted, and I got to believe there's nerves and family is in the ballpark. I'm thinking, and what do you remember about that day?
I vividly remember all 35 of my family that I had left tickets for. That's great. You know, the place was packed. Now we did play two exhibition games a couple nights before it, and we played the Phillies.
Okay.
So
interesting.
So this is the opening of the Metrodome. The very first, you know, so I became the starting center fielder, the leadoff hitter in the very first games of the Metrodome. Now I always have a joke for my friends and the trivia thing is like, I got the very first Twins hit, but who got the very first hit in the Metrodome?
82 for would it have been the Phillies?
Yeah, number 14.
Oh, there you go, Pete Rose.
There it is.
How about that?
Get off hitter, base it up the middle.
Yeah.
There, you know, and that's so anyway, to opening day, you know, it's kind of crazy. You know, it's you get introduced. I'm the starting center fielder. So we come in and we're playing the Seattle Mariners. Floyd Bannister is the pitcher for the Mariners. And I remember, you know, I was 0-for-4.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what I remember. You know, we lost the game, came back the next night and I got my first major league hit. I'll never forget. It was kind of a tipped off the second baseman's glove into the right field.
It's like, did I hear you right? You said line drive into the gap. Is that what you said?
That's what it looked like in the book. But
exactly,
you know,
right.
Murph, I'm being honest with you.
Take them any way you can get them.
It
right?
Looked the same. Exactly.
That's one thing that hasn't changed in the game. We'll take them any way they can get them. So a young team in Minnesota at the time, which I would imagine made things maybe a little bit easier as you, you know, integrate into the big leagues. But it's quite the change in lifestyle as you hit the major leagues and you begin your career. And for you, added challenges because soon after is when you started again to have your health issues with the Tourette syndrome. But at the time, they didn't know what it was. You were getting misdiagnosed and it became over the next couple of seasons a very difficult time in your life. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that's probably true, right?
It was very difficult, but I look back and, you know, even the college story, going to St. Cloud versus the University of Minnesota, when I went to Elizabethan, I was always in the right place at the right time. You know, there was a plan for what I was doing. And even though that was very difficult, you know, not really knowing, I could never, and I never really knew how to convince the Twins medical people that I've been doing these ticks and things since I was 6 or 7 years old.
Right.
You know, they couldn't go back to my childhood elementary, second grade, you know, Catholic school with the nuns. You know, they did. I couldn't tell them what I did. I didn't know how to. It didn't resonate. They thought, okay, it's a new young kid, you know, pretty sheltered, you know, he's in the big limelight now and stage fright. It's like, well, that was the only relief I ever got was playing the sport. And right. Now I'm starting to think about, okay, now it's bothering me, you know, I can still play, but it's bothering me to the point where I didn't really want to play and it was hurting, you know? Yeah. So mentally and physically, it was a mess for me for a couple of years. But right. Like I said, I was in the right place at the right time. And I had access to the probably some of the best medical people in the world being part of a major league team.
And yet it still took some time. You knew what it wasn't, but you didn't really know what it was there for a couple of seasons, correct? I mean, it wasn't until what, after 85, that you really got the diagnosis of, okay, here's what this is and here's how we can treat it, that allowed you to come back to the game that you love and actually enjoy the game again. Because when you stepped away, I read a quote that you said it just wasn't worth it anymore. It wasn't enjoyable for you because I guess you were spending so much time focused in on what wasn't working. Correct.
Right. That's absolutely correct. And part of it too, it's such a misdiagnosed, misunderstood, but in nature, it's a physical problem. But because of that, it mentally, it drives you crazy. You sure. know, it's not like a slump going 0-for-30. That's bad enough. But this was something where you just couldn't even get up in the morning and feel like, so mentally you become a wreck, you know, mm-hmm. And that's how I was. So once I got the diagnosis and realized what it was, realized that I wasn't the only one and there is help, it started to kind of lift the weight off my shoulders about that. And once I started to get the physical help, well, then I had to work on myself, you know, accepting that's what it was, learning how to use that and still play or whatever I was going to do. That's where I did make the comments that it's not worth playing to feel miserable. You know, and so, you know, I eventually got there. And when I came back to the Royals in 87, I wasn't expecting I really wasn't expecting anything to move forward. I wanted the chance to try. And that's what I got. And I make a joke about I didn't bargain for another 12 years, you know,
which is what part of what makes your story remarkable. Just to put it in perspective, two full seasons that you didn't play in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. And just before we move on from the topic, what were you doing at that point? Odd jobs and hanging around? I know you kept your bat in the sport at a lower level, but mm-hmm. but certainly not professional ball.
Right. I went back to school as I was drafted after my junior year. So yeah. I had some credits to take care of yet. And I went and did that. I did take some odd jobs. And, you know, I had a builder friend who I helped paint houses for him. Just did things like that. And I, like you said, I did keep in shape by playing like slow pitch softball a couple nights a week. And then had amateur baseball on the weekends. And amateur baseball in Minnesota is a big deal. It still kind of is. And so that's what I did, you know, and it was there just to have exercise, to have fun, you know, and just to get a relief from all the stuff that had happened. So that's kind of what I did, you know?
Well, then Kansas City comes a calling. And at that point you had been, you know, had kind of figured out the Tourette syndrome and were able to give it another shot. What was that like? Because Major League Baseball debut, 22-year-old, that happens often, right? And you, mm-hmm. and most of you have the same kind of experience, the nerves, that this, but a comeback, and maybe that's the wrong word, but to come back and then after 2 years of absence in the big leagues and say to yourself, I can do this and I can do it at a high level. What was that like for you?
Well, first of all, it was right place at right time again. You know, that fall of 86, my second full year out of baseball, my buddy Bob from college had played his 7 years in the minor leagues.
Wow.
And he got one call up to the Royals big league team in 85, played third base for one inning, did not get a ball, never batted, and after 4 days was sent back to AAA. Wow. So being who he was, he knew after that season he was not going to make it. And so he became part of the Royals front office. Well, in the fall of 86, he called me. He checking in, see how I'm doing. And one thing led to another. He kind of figured out I'd like to try again. And he made the arrangements for me to have a chance to play. And so we had to go through a few steps to make that happen. But there I was in Royals spring training clubhouse in 87. And I didn't, like I said, I had no expectations other than to give it my best. If I didn't make it, I was fine. At least I tried. If I never would have tried or taken an opportunity, that would have driven me nuts. And I don't, you know, and so, and that's where I didn't bargain for another 12 years, but
yeah.
I went into it just, you know, going to do the best I can, have fun playing again, and whatever happens, happens. And that's kind of was my attitude.
It sounds to me like no doubts, right? You thought, okay, you know, why not? It's right there in front of me. I've done it before. And I can do it again. I mean, but you know, you're 28 years old at this point too. Mm-hmm. Still young and in your prime. But what was there any part of you that said, well, I don't know if this is a good idea?
Not really, no, because I didn't have the expectation. You know, baseball is funny. You know, you can attribute baseball the batting part of it to life. You know, you're if you're 3 out of 10, you're good.
Yeah.
You know, well, but each time you strike out, you got to turn the page and go to the next one. And each time you get a hit or hit a home run, you got to turn the page too, because it's done, you know, and I was good at that. You know, okay. I remember being in the Phillies clubhouse in 93, where I didn't even play a game. And after the game we lost, the reporters would come up. I don't know if you were one of them,
could have been.
They would just ask. They'd ask me because I was the one who would talk to them, and they'd say, "Well, you know, they'd ask about the game," and I would just say, "Well, we didn't do this." I said, "Yeah, but you didn't play today." "Yeah, but I'm on the team. This is what I did," and they got used to that. And so I never, you know, we have to turn the page. I never would throw anyone under the bus. We just didn't do that.
Right.
You know, that was for us to know, and didn't matter what. You know, your profession.
Hey, I get it. So,
and so it, but that's how I treated it.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. A bad day doesn't mean the next day is going to be bad or good or whatever it is. So that's how I looked at it. So my expectations were to do the best I could in every day that I played.
Well, you certainly did that. You come back, you play 6 seasons in Kansas City, and each season, seemed to get better and better for you. Obviously you were a blessed hitter, a guy that just was able to consistently be a great hitter. And then for us here in Philadelphia, 1993 arrives and you come over as a free agent. And I've talked to so many of your teammates over the years about just what it was like to be part of that 1993 team. I don't know that anybody had an idea coming into spring training just what it would be like, but you're a veteran player at this point. You've had success in the big leagues. It'll be your first time in the National League. Is that true? Yes. The first time in the National League. Yeah. What was that experience like? Because that was a pretty crazy clubhouse right from the get-go.
It was. And I was 34 years old. So when I was leaving the Royals, the time could be up. You know, I didn't know.
Sure.
In the off season, the Phillies were the only one to offer a big league contract. I had an offer from the Braves to to come to spring training, but then probably play in AAA.
Right.
And, you know, I was married at the time, you know, and we had a young daughter and son, and it's like, you know, let's go to Philly. Cause anyway, so we get to Philly and meet all the guys, you know, Johnny and Darren and Dave Hollins, and, you know, they're all there. And they made me feel welcome pretty much right away just by being their goofy selves, you know. And I didn't know this then, but 92 was not a good year for the Phillies.
No, it was not.
And that's what everybody expected. I remember seeing a video of Mariano Duncan and might have been Mickey in the dugout, or Ricky Jordan maybe, and they're saying, you know, they expect us to be another last place team, but I think we need another one of these. And Mariano points to his ring on the finger, you know, from his World Series, I think, with the red.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, we didn't know it, but I just, spring training went like unbelievably good. I remember coming in the clubhouse after about the 2 weeks and Larry Anderson, just another lousy one run win, you know, and it's kind of, we just won every game, you know, it seemed great. And then the season started, of course, and then, you know, we never looked back, but we never assumed anything.
Right.
The guys were, it's the neatest bunch of guys you could ever be around in a sports team. I always wished my kids kind of know some of the guys, at least my older ones. And I wish their teams could have had the camaraderie that we did. You know, we heard jokes about guys wanting to come with us just because they knew what we were like.
Yeah. That group in 93, that one year. And I know a lot of the guys were here in 94, 95. Mm-hmm. But that particular season, it's why we still talk about it today here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. It was one of the most, I was a senior, or I had just graduated college and was just getting into the business. Mm-hmm. And I was covering that team as an intern, and just the magical run in the city of Philadelphia. It was like nothing we had experienced, certainly nothing I had experienced in my life, because the team had not been good for so long. And I think that's, you know, part of it was the way you guys played. Part of it was the way you were perceived. But part of it was just the way you took so seriously the game, the importance of what was happening from the first inning to the ninth inning each and every night. And, you know, I've talked to your teammates about it, but was that unique in 93? Had you experienced anything like that in the big leagues before?
No. I came from the Royals, where that was a very successful team. You know, yeah. George Brett and Willie Wilson and Frank White and Brett Saberhagen and Mark Gubazov and Dan Quisenberry. And these guys were really good, but it wasn't the same clubhouse. You know, Bo Jackson was a teammate.
Absolutely.
You know, all these guys they're great guys. I see a lot of them still today because I live here. Mm-hmm. But it was a different clubhouse. You know, it almost seemed like there was the hierarchy of George and Frank White and Willie Wilson. And then rest of the guys were there. But and that's no reflection on us, because Frank White's one of my best friends. Mm-hmm. George was one of the best teammates. And, you know, George is like Mike Schmidt.
Yeah.
But he's here in Kansas City. They're the same guy.
Yep.
You know, but different, you know.
Yeah.
But the clubhouse there was different than when I got to Philly. And I don't know how to explain it, but the Philly clubhouse was like you could take a bunch of guys from downtown Philly, put them in the clubhouse, and you couldn't tell the difference between anybody.
Yeah. And I know Aaron gets a lot of credit for that, as he should. Mm-hmm. But certainly some of the other guys you mentioned, John and Larry, that consistently kept it light, you know, Milt and Wes, you know, you could go through the entire roster. It just worked. And mm-hmm. you're going through this magical season. It started off terrifically. You guys put the pedal to the metal, and you really never looked back. What do you have a favorite moment or memory that during that season that you say to yourself, you know, that's kind of when I knew that this was something special. Can you put your finger on anything like that?
You know, we always talk about Mariano's Grand Slam on Mother's Day.
That was awesome.
You know, I mean, as bad as everybody talked about Veterans Stadium, when there were 40 to 60,000 people there, it's as electric as and really cool as you could ever imagine. Yep. And that's what I just never forget, you know? Every time I go back and look at the videos, I get chills, you know, watching. And so that was a big deal. I remember having the stadium filled. Like, I don't know what the, we went into September and every home date averaged like 40,000 people until we got to late September where then school started. So we were not quite 30 or so, you know, it was crazy. And then the playoffs came and it was just, but it was, that Mariano's home run was a big deal.
Yeah.
There was the two nights we played or the doubleheader that lasted into the morning.
The Michigan game. Yep. Yep.
It was stupidly fun.
Yeah. Yeah. there are so many of those particular like singular moments during that season that here we are, what, 30 years later, believe it or not. And we're still talking about it. That's what makes it so special. Obviously you don't win the World Series, but it certainly matters, but in the grand scheme of things, you guys in 93 will always be beloved for what you did for this city that season, win or lose. And that's why when you guys come back and you do often, which is great. I know you're still close mm-hmm. with so many of your teammates. It just starts all over again. It's like home week all over again when you guys mm-hmm. get together, is it not?
Yeah, it for sure is. Yeah. Yep.
Then you get so you spend a couple more years in Philadelphia and good years, really good mm-hmm. years. If you look back at the numbers, some of the best years of your career. And then mm-hmm. that gave you one more opportunity to play in a World Series because you head to Florida in 97. You get reunited with Darren Dalton. You're one of the few guys that played with Dutch on two different teams. Mm-hmm. And you get reunited and you guys do what, I don't know. I think back then, no one thought was going to be possible. Here's this expansion team that is still very young. And next thing you know, they've put together a team and you guys are in the World Series. What do you remember best about that season?
Well, we actually, talk about 30 years of the Phillies, we just had our 25-year anniversary of the Marlins World Series 2 weeks ago.
Oh, awesome.
So I was in Miami and Jim Leland, and that's kind of says it right there. I had two gyms and, you know, being a gym myself, I mean, they were the best, you know, and we just had a group of guys that were really good players. I wouldn't say we were close like my Philly group, but we had the right mix. We had the right coaches and, you know, we played well at the right time. Now we were lucky in some ways because that was the first year of the wild card.
Yeah, right.
So we were the wild card team. You know, we were not going to win the division. The Braves had a handle on that. And so we were lucky in that respect. And so, but at the same time, you know, you mentioned Darren, and when Darren came over, I think he kind of ignited us a little bit and kind of showed what we had and what we really should have been. And, you know, it does take luck, but we had some good players and we ran through it and ended up with the ring.
With the ring. Hey, do me a favor. Tell the story, because you've told me this story before, but mm-hmm. tell the story about when Darren came to Florida mm-hmm. and he was watching. I won't tell the story. He'd been there a couple of days and decided to say, hey, guys, let's huddle up. I got something to say.
Yeah, well, we were in Cincinnati. And I always tell the story, if you remember old Riverfront Stadium, from the dugout to the clubhouse is a long walk, and it's kind of a grungy little hallway. And so Darren got there, and it wasn't the 31st of July. It was a few days before that he came over, and he met us in Cincinnati. So the first game he's there, we lose the game kind of stupidly and come back the next day and do the same thing. And so after that second game, the game's over and everybody's getting ready to go to the clubhouse. Darren says, "No, wait, can I have her say a few words here?" And he had all the coaches, the bat boys, and all the people in the dugout just go up to the clubhouse and just the players. And he said, "I've only been here for a couple of days, and you act like you're a bleeping country club, like you don't even care. You're better than that." And that's all he said. We went up, you know, and if you think about the guys we had on the team, it's like,
yeah,
okay, you know, whatever. Daddy's giving us a spanking or right. something. You know, it's like, okay, whatever. And so the next day, Darren is the first baseman. And his first at bat, he hits a broken bat, little blooper over the first baseman's head and turns it into a double. You know, Darren's knees were bad. And so that to me, and Geis mentioned it 2 weeks ago too, that when he got to second, the guys believed that what he said the night before, even though it only took about 10 seconds or 15 seconds to say it, he meant what he said and he was going to do what he said too himself. And yeah. So that's when we turned the season over right there. We started interleague play, which meant we're not going to play the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Orioles, in between the Braves. And we won at least 3 out of 4 of every one of those series in the first part of August and put us back into contention to get into the playoffs. And even though we were a wild card, it got us in.
Got it.
That was a big deal.
Get you in the tournament, and then and next thing you know, yeah. You're wearing the ring. I love that story. It says a lot about Dutch, but it also says a lot about the guys on that Marlins team that were willing to kind of take a step back and look in the mirror and say, okay, maybe he's right. He's been here 48 hours, but maybe he's figured us out already. Great story. All right, we're running out of time. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I do have one more thing I want to mention, and I would think that you know this, but many of our listeners may not know this, and this is just such a cool stat that I found. So in 1996, you batted .361 for the Phillies, which is a remarkable season, .361. I mean, we may not see that again for another decade right now. You were 37 years old at the time. There are only 3 other players in Major League Baseball history that age 37 or older hit higher than .360. Do you know this stat? Do you know who those 3 are?
I do not know that. I think there's one though that I might know.
Well, you want to take a guess?
Was he a former Philly?
No former no. Philly. So it's a remarkable list. Let me tell
Tony
you.
Gwynn.
Tony Gwynn is one.
Rod Carew.
Barry Bonds is no. 2.
Really?
And Ted Williams is 3.
Yeah.
And Ted.
I shouldn't know that.
Well, I mean, but. This is in the history of baseball, and Jim Eisenreich is the 4th on that list, and that's it. I think that's just awesome. I know you don't play the game for those kinds of things, but to be linked with Williams and Gwynn and Bonds, 3 of the greatest hitters ever to play the game, that's kind of cool, right?
It's kind of cool. Yeah. I don't want to get a big head. It's big enough.
You know? Jim, I don't think that's possible. I really feel I wanted to pat you on the back for that one. It's really great. All right. So before I let you go, nowadays, you're obviously retired and living in Kansas City and doing great work with the Jim Eisenreich Foundation. Talk a little bit quickly about what you guys do and what the mission is and how rewarding that must be for you, knowing your path and everything that you overcame to be the ball player that you were.
Well, the intention there was to help kids and families that are dealing with Tourette now, you know, just, and we started the foundation as a formality back in 96. Now I've always talked to kids and all that. And so the goal of our foundation is we say success for every kid with Tourette. All we do is really provide awareness. And in some ways we give them hope that it's going to be okay. And I use myself as an example that you can be whatever you want to be. More so now we're trying to be a resource to get parents the answers to their questions about what to do. you know, and so we're not a research, we know we're not medical. There's other groups that do that, and that's fine. I personally want the kids to be able to go to school and have a good day at school. Yeah. You know, so that's what we do. The COVID years now have kind of set things back because we can't get into and talk to them, but I've done a couple of Zoom calls and I have recently gotten back into classrooms or areas where I can meet with groups and talk. And that's really all we do. I tell them my story, you know, and it's hard to believe for the young kids now, because now I'm an old gray beard guy and, you know, they don't even mean you played. So I got to show the video of our Phillies and, you know, and yeah, that was me and that, you know, a long time ago. So that's kind of what we do. And, just trying to create awareness and a whole another generation of families is coming in wanting answers to those questions. And so we're here to hopefully answer those.
Well, thank goodness that you are. It's an incredible resource and probably resonates more than you'll ever know with some of those young kids who are just now learning that this is going to be part of who they are and how mm-hmm. they can navigate it going forward. I mean, you're a terrific example of exactly how to handle it, and we're very glad that you're able to share your stories with us, and we really appreciate it, Jim. Oh, it's always good to talk to you. Probably could do this for another hour, but I'm not going to do that to you, so
yep, probably.
Yeah. Jim Eisenreich joining us here on Glove Stories with Murph. Thanks so much. A terrific career. You brought so much joy to the city of Philadelphia, you and your teammates, and I know you know that, and we look forward to getting you back here to Philadelphia at some point this season, I'm sure. We'll see you here in Philly, and we'll talk then, okay?
That sounds great. Thank you, Greg.
All right.
Appreciate it.
All right, Jim Eisenreich joining us. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Charlie Manuel, Larry Boa stop by on the podcast, so stay with us.
The all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app is here for both Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Get in on all the action, whether it's baseball, the basketball and hockey playoffs, golf, all your favorite sports. Download the all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app and make your first bet risk-free up to $750. Bet more than the score. Bet on individual player performances for hits, home runs, and strikeouts. Bet innings, first team to score, and more. Bet Parks is the only sportsbook and casino app that I recommend. The Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app, where odds, bets, slots, and games all come together in perfect harmony right in your pocket. Sportsbook and all your favorite casino games for real money, all in one amazing app. Live in-game betting lets you bet while you watch the game. Download right now in the App Store, Google Play Store, or at betparks.com and use my promo code MURF. Bet Parks is also an official proud betting operator of the PGA Tour. The all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app. You must be 21 and in Pennsylvania or New Jersey. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome to This Week in Philly Baseball History, presented by Scheib Vintage Sports. This week in 1939, Scheib Park hosted its first night game featuring National League clubs. Philadelphia's Hirsch Martin notched two hits in a 5-2 loss against Pittsburgh. Baseball's first ever night game was held in 1935 when Cincinnati hosted Philadelphia. Celebrate Philly sports history with a unique Father's Day gift from Scheib Vintage Sports. Visit them at 13th and Walnut Streets or scheibsports.com.
Phillies Nation is your source for breaking news, original analysis, trade insights, and more. Read today's articles at philliesnation.com.
Welcome back to Glove Stories with Murph, brought to you by the Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app, Scheib Vintage Sports, and Phillies Nation. We thank them for being a part of Glove Stories, and we welcome in Charlie Manuel and Larry Boa, as we do every week. And guys, we're talking playmakers this week, guys that always seem to be right in the middle of things, and as a manager, a coach, or a teammate, are the guys that can turn things on a dime when you need something to happen. Those are generally the guys that make things happen. You know, baseball is such an individual sport at times, and sometimes you just need a guy to say, hey, put it on my shoulders and I'll take care of it. Bo, let me start with you. Is there a guy from your playing days, your coaching days, that stands out for you?
Well, obviously managing, especially my very first year managing in San Diego. You know, I only managed 1 year in AAA, and they gave me that job. And The one guy, and you know, everyone's going to say, oh, that's easy to predict that. But Tony Gwynn was a great, I'm talking about a great hitter, a great teammate, great in the clubhouse. And, you know, when you get a job like that, you know he's good. And then we get to watch him every single day. You go, oh, my God, this guy is really special. He stands out. Jimmy Rollins stands out for me because I took over in 2001. I could see that he was going to be one of those guys that wasn't afraid to voice his opinion, played the game very hard, came up in big spots all the time, wasn't afraid of the big moment.
Right.
I got a whole bunch of them, really, Murph. Tomey, we got Tomey as a free agent. He's a guy that in the eighth or ninth inning, you want him up there. You're down a run or two, a couple guys on. And like I said, Derek Jeter, I was a coach for the Yankees. Those four guys, the guys like that, they're not afraid of the moment, Murph. They want to be up there. And I asked Jeter one time, I said, how come you're so successful at this? He says, because I'm not afraid to fail. And if I do fail, I'm not afraid to turn the page and say, hey, I hope I come up next tomorrow night in the same situation. And when you get guys like that, that aren't afraid to fail in key situations, you have something special in my mind.
No doubt about it. I mean, that's not just true in baseball. Yeah, that kind of mentality will serve you pretty well in life as well. But, And you know, watching Derek Jeter from afar, that's exactly how he appeared to us as fans. You know, a guy that was ready for the moment, wanted the moment, and ready to do it again the next day, for sure. Charlie, I know you've been around some great, great players in your career and your playing days and your coaching days. What about you? Playmakers for you that you just kind of sat back and were in awe of?
Yeah, you know, Murph, when I listen to Bo talk, I agree with everything he said about Jimmy Rollins, because of Jimmy's talent, his speed, his switch hitter. He was a prototype kind of player, and he was energy. You know, like he bought life energy. Everything he did was kind of that way. And I think Bo hit right on him. There's sluggers like Tomey, Howard, in situations. If you go back and look at his career from a seventh inning on, how he hit and things like that in big moments. I remember, if you go back and look at Brian Howard's pinch hit numbers, they were absolutely amazing because he would hit a homer or extra base hits. And on days that he's sick, I'd still use him, and he made some big hits for us. But when I'm thinking about the kind of player that you're saying, or I want to talk about, I think comes up in my mind first, Kirby Puckett.
Wow, good one, yeah.
Energy, life, bubbly kind of guy. He made it, always kept clubhouse bench was always electrifying when he's around. He always had a big smile and a hustle. He ran every ball out, and he had power, and he was fun to watch play in the outfield, run the ball down and stuff like that. And then his hitting, of course, he could definitely come up with big hits. Then my second guy, when I really get down to it, at one time I thought Ricky Henderson did as much in baseball as anybody possibly could do. He's the guy that always got it started. He was always in on rallies in the game. Also, he could run the ball down in the outfield. And, of course, you know, like he could get in scoring position real easy. And, you know, like, but anything, all I think, the players, when he's talented and he shows the fast guys, speed don't go in the slump. I've heard Bo say that a lot. And speed don't go in the slump because he puts pressure on the other team in defense or offense and things like that. And when you look at players like that, and when like Ricky Henderson could still hit homers and things like that, Puckett same way, you know, like those are guys who control the game. But at the same time, big hitters who hit in the clutch or big moments of the game, that speaks for itself. And, you know, like they're not very hard to find if you pull out the record books and things like that. But the complete players is guys like, for me, it's like a Puckett or Ricky Henderson, Jimmy Rollins. Kenny Lofton was a flyer. He didn't have as much power, although he could hit a home run as those other guys. But now he was an electrifying player. Ishiro. I mean, you can go back and you can keep naming players that definitely play a part on setting the table and also can win the game for you.
Yeah.
You know, Murph, I think the one thing that Charlie, the names he mentioned and the names I mentioned as a manager, as a coach, if those guys were 0-for-10 and they came up in crucial situations, sometimes guys would, as a manager coach, say, God, I wish somebody else was hitting. But all those guys that we mentioned, I'll take my chances with them if they're 0-for-10, 0-for-12, because they had a way of rising to the occasion and putting the previous at bats behind them. And they give you what they had in the eighth or ninth inning. And those guys are special, believe me. And the guys that we both named, all of them were very special.
Yeah. Pete Rose, I'd put him on that list. The guy.
Oh, no question. Yeah,
he goes on our, hey, Murph, he goes on my list.
Yep. Absolutely. What about anyone with the glove? I mean, the first one that comes to mind, I guess, is Ozzie Smith, who could, you know, change a game.
Right.
With his glove. Anybody else that you think that, you know, in a moment, everybody's thinking, all right, you know, if the ball's hit to this guy, we're in good shape kind of thing.
Well, when I played, Keith Hernandez to me at first base was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, not only just catching the ground ball, but fielding bunts, not afraid to throw to the second base, charging on a bunt play or third base on a bunt play. People don't understand, you know, you see a lot of people in baseball say, oh, throw this guy over at first base. Little do they know, besides the catcher, the first baseman handles the ball more than anybody. And you got a guy over there that can catch the ball, short hops and everything like that, save infielders from errors. He can make a difference defensively as well as offensively, but he stands out for me. And another guy that when I played or managed, I should say, was Mark Grace. Those guys that play first base and can do it on both sides of the ball, they're very special, believe me.
Yeah. Hey, Charlie, the guy on the screen with us, Larry Ball, he could pick it too in the big moments, right?
Yeah. He could pick it. Hey, definitely. Hey, he goes in there. Hey, Murph, I liked, I think Brooks Robinson playing third base and the way he did it. I think it, earlier in his career, you know, like he wasn't known as such a great hitter or nothing like that. And I think his defense actually helped. As his offense improved, his defense really helped him become a more known player as a star player. I think it. I think sometime when you see look and you see in Smitty, Bo can tell you about his defense. He was a prototype third baseman, and you're like those guys. You know, they're very consistent, but at the same time, they can make big plays in big moments. And like he said, it's all about just relaxing and can handle that moment. And those are the players that stand out. And usually those are energy players.
Yeah, energy players, right. Bo, you wanted the last word on that?
Well, Schmitty was – I got to play alongside this guy my whole career. And you talk about making my job easier. I mean, he could go to his left better than anybody I've ever seen. I didn't get a chance to see Brooks. He was in the American League, but I saw a video of him. Those two guys were the best in their respective, one in the American, one in the National League. But when you get a guy like Schmitty, for me, that means I can move towards the middle of the diamond a little bit. People don't understand that when you have a third baseman that can go left and right, it makes everybody's job so much easier. And I had the luxury of watching this guy do it my whole career. And when they say the greatest third baseman of all time here, I tip my hat because he is. Again, Brooks taking nothing from Brooks. I never got to see him. I saw enough video saying this guy's special, but Schmitty was really special.
Yeah, Mike gets the nod for sure. Absolutely. Go ahead, Charlie.
Hey, Murph, I'll give Bo some kudos. You know, he goes in there with the guy, you know, like at like Jimmy Rollins and Bo, Omar Vizquel, and guys like that. They could always come up with a big plays, but at the same time, it came because they were so consistent. And when they needed it, you would see them make the big plays, and you took them. If you weren't careful, you'd take them for granted that they were supposed to catch everything, because that's, you know, like, and basically that's kind of what happens in a game. You know, like in big moments, they catch, you know, like they handle the ball, and guys like Bo and those guys. You know, like not only do they have the ball in the big moment, but they're very consistent on all the plays in the game. You know, like that's why they become real good defensive players.
Yeah, take them for granted, but I think that's a compliment, right? You know,
exactly.
We just expect it. We just expect
it. That is a compliment. Yeah.
Not about it. All right, guys, playmakers, you can't win without them. You need a couple of those guys on your team, and we certainly listed a couple of good ones. All right, guys, we'll see you next week, another topic, and we'll debate that coming up next week. Thanks.
Welcome to This Week in Philly Baseball History, presented by Schaub Vintage Sports. This week in 1939, Schaub Park hosted its first night game featuring National League clubs. Philadelphia's Hirsch Martin notched two hits in a 5-2 loss against Pittsburgh. Baseball's first ever night game was held in 1935 when Cincinnati hosted Philadelphia. Celebrate Philly sports history with a unique Father's Day gift from Schaub Vintage Sports. Visit them at 13th and Walnut Streets or schaubsports.com.
The all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app is here for both Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Get in on all the action, whether it's baseball, the basketball and hockey playoffs, golf, all your favorite sports. Download the all-new Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app and make your first bet risk-free up to $750. Bet more than the score. Bet on individual player performances for hits, home runs, and strikeouts. Bet innings, first team to score, and more. BetParks is the only sportsbook and casino app that I recommend. The BetParks Casino and Sportsbook app, where odds, bets, slots, and games all come together in perfect harmony right in your pocket. Sportsbook and all your favorite casino games for real money, all in one amazing app. Live in-game betting lets you bet while you watch the game. Download right now in the App Store, Google Play Store, or at BetParks.com and use my promo code MURF. BetParks is also an official proud betting operator of the PGA Tour. The all-new BetParks Casino and Sportsbook app. You must be 21 and in Pennsylvania or New Jersey. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Phillies Nation is your source for breaking news, original analysis, trade insights, and more. Read today's articles at PhilliesNation.com. Glove Stories with Murph is sponsored by the Bet Parks Casino and Sportsbook app, along with Shine Vintage Sports and Phillies Nation, and is a presentation of SBC Media Partners. The engineer for Glove Stories is Chad Evans. Cindy Webster is our marketing and guest relations director, and our executive producer is Roger Haddon. Whether you are watching us on YouTube or downloading the podcast from one of the major podcast providers like Apple, Google, or Spotify, make sure to hit like and subscribe so that we can let you know when a new episode of Glove Stories is available. We'll release new episodes weekly throughout the 2022 Major League Baseball season.